tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to part 17 of our continuing series with Henry Ford's The International Jew. I am your host, Ted Midward. The first part of the segment today is entitled, How Jews Capitalized a Protest Against Jews. Let's jump right into it. The American stage is under the influence and control of a group of former bootblacks, newsboys, ticket speculators, prize ring habitués, and Bowery characters. At the present writing, the most advertised man in the world of theatrical production is Morris Guest, a Russian Jew who has produced the most salacious spectacles ever shown in America, that being Aphrodite and Mecca. It is reported that the scent of the nastiness has been so strongly circulated among theatergoers that tickets are sold a year ahead for the Chicago exhibition of one of these shows, the patrons being, of course, mostly Gentiles. Now, it is a fair question, who is this Morris Guest who stalks before his fellow Jews as the most successful producer of the year? It is nothing against him to say that he came from Russia. It is nothing against him to say that he is a Jew. It is nothing against him to say that, although success has favored him, his father and mother are still in Odessa, or were until recently. Yet, in a recent interview, in which the professional note of pathos was obtrusively present, he lamented that he was not able to bring his parents to America. The story of Morris Guest is the last one in the world to use as a success story of the type of the poor immigrant boy who became a great theatrical producer narrative. He is not a great producer, of course, although he is a great panderer to the least credible tastes of the public, whose taste has been no mean factor in debasing. Guest sold newspapers in Boston and became property boy in a Boston theater. In 1906, he was a member of a notorious gang of ticket speculators who were the bane of the public until ticket peddling on the sidewalks in front of theaters was finally suppressed by the police. There are still other stories about him that link his name with another sort of traffic, but whether these stories are true or not, there is nothing in Guest's character to indicate that he would ever contribute anything to the theater's best interest. He is the son-in-law of David Belasco. Then there is Sam Harris, the long junior partner of the firm Cohen and Harris, who began his career in the arts by managing Dixon, the colored champion featherweight pugilist, and the redoubtable Terry McGovern, champion lightweight prize fighter. With tastes formed at the ringside, he launched into theatrical ventures, allying himself with Al Woods. He catered to the lower classes and made a fortune by producing atrocious melodramas in second and third class houses. And yet this is the Sam Harris who commands the patronage of hundreds of thousands, yes, millions of theatergoers, some of whom go on innocently believing that when they invade the theater they also enter, by some mystical process, the realms of art. Al H. Woods has but one good eye. It is not his personal loss that matters, but the history of the misfortune which goes back to the time when Al was a member of an East Side gang. The common report was that he used to play the piano in a downtown place, east of Fifth Avenue. Mr. Woods is also a distinguished patron of dramatic art. He presented The Girl from Rector's and The Girl in the Taxi, two of the most immoral and pointless shows of recent years. Several times he has secured the rights to certain Viennese operas, which were bad enough in themselves from a moral point of view, but which were at least constructed with true artistry. But even these he marred by an inept infusion of vulgarity and blague. The public, of course, does not see and does not know these gods before whom they pour their millions yearly, nor does the public know from what source theatric vileness comes. It is amusing to listen to the fledgling philosophers discuss the tendencies of the stage, or expatiate learnedly on the divine right of art, to be as flippantly and as filthy as it pleases, when all the time the tendency is started and the art is determined by men whose antecedents would make art scream. The American Theater is a small group of Jewish promoters and a large group of Gentile gullibles, and it is only the latter who kid themselves that there is anything real about the matter. It's perfectly natural, therefore, that the complete Judaization of the theater should result in its being transformed into the show business, a mere matter of trade and barter. The real producers are often not culturally equipped for anything more than the baldest business. They can hire what they want, mechanics, painters, writers, musicians. With their gauge of public taste and their models of action formed upon the racetrack and the prize ring, with their whole ideal modeled upon the ambition to pander to depravity instead of serving legitimate needs, it is not surprising that the standards of the theater should not be at their lowest mark. As theatergoers are noticing more and more, the Jewish manager, whenever possible, employs Jewish actors and actresses. Gentile playwrights and actors are steadily diminishing in number for want of a market. At times, the employment of Jewish actors has been so obtrusive as to endanger the success of the play. This was notably the case when the part of a young Christian girl of the early Christian era was given to a Jewess of pronounced racial features. The selection was so glaringly inept, ethnically and historically, that it militated strongly against the impression the play was intended to produce. The cover name conceals the theater-going public the fact that the actors and actresses who purvey entertainment are, in large and growing proportion, Jewish. Some of the more prominent Jewish actors, many of them prime favorites, are Al Jolson, Charlie Chaplin, Louis Mann, Sam Bernard, David Warfield, Joe Weber, Barney Bernard, Ed Wynn, or to mention his real name, Israel Leopold, Lou Fields, Eddie Cantor, and Robert Warwick. Among the prominent Jewish actresses are Theda Bara, Nora Bayes, Olga Nethersall, Irene Franklin, Gertrude Hoffman, Mizi Hajos, Fanny Bryce, Bertha Kalish, Josie Collins, Ethel Levy, Belle Baker, Constance Collier. The late Anna Held was also a Jewess. In addition to these are the others whose racial identity is not revealed by their names or any public knowledge about them. The Jewish press claims for the Jews, aside from the commercial control of the stage, the control of the fun-making business. The greatest entertainers, vaudevillains, and fun-makers are Jews, says an article to the Chicago Jewish Sentinel, commenting on the extent to which Jewish actors monopolized the Chicago stage that week. Among the composers we once beheld, Victor Herbert and Gustav Kircher, in honorable places, but now the Irving Berlins have forced themselves into places hewn out and established by Gentiles who had a regard for art. There are no great Jewish playwrights. Charles Klein wrote The Lion and the Mouse, but never repeated. There is, of course, much commonplace work turned out for the stage. A commercialized stage needs a certain amount of product. Among those engaged in such work are Jack Late, Montauk Glass, Samuel Shipman, Jules Eckert Goodman, Aaron Hoffman, and others. The Jewish claim to exceptional genius is not borne out by the theater, although the Jewish will to power is therein amply illustrated. Belasco's name comes to mind, perhaps oftener than any, and Belasco is the most consummate actor off any stage. To understand Mr. Belasco is to understand the method by which the Independents fought the Jewish theater trust, and still retain the monopoly of the theater for the Jews. The old trust was bowling along merrily, smashing everything in its way, thrusting honored stars into obscurity, blocking the path of promising playwrights, putting out of business all actors who would not prostitute art to commercialism, and there occurred what always occurs, for even the Jews are not superior to natural law. A bad case of big head was developed. Claw, Erlanger, and their immediate associates felt themselves to be kings and began to exhibit a few supposedly royal idiosyncrasies. There were some protests, of course, against the arrogance of the czars of the theater. The Vanderbilts and other New York millionaires embodied their protest in a movement toward a national theater, which was erected at Grand Central Park, and for which $1 million was spent. One of the members of the trust provided his birth and breeding by saying that this attempt to cleanse the theater was really only a plan to provide a place of vice for the benefit of the millionaire backers. The remark inspired deep rancor, but was more revelatory of the Jewish trust's essential conception of the theater, more so than anything else. Belasco came from San Francisco, where he had done various stunts, including those of an itinerant recitationist, illusionist, and actor. James E. Hearn took an interest in him as a youth and discovered him to be adept at helping himself to dialogues out of printed displays. Under Hearn, Belasco learned much about stage effects and soon became very successful in touching up defective plays. Coming to New York, Belasco fell in with DeMille, a Jewish writer for the stage, who only needed Belasco's sense of the theater to make his qualities effective. Belasco became a factor in enlarging the Jewish control of the stage in this way. He was connected with the Frohmans, but was unable to persuade them that Mrs. Leslie Carter, who had been the center of a sensational divorce suit and who had placed herself under Mr. Belasco's professional direction, was a great actress. The making of a star out of Mrs. Carter, and the gaining of public recognition for her, proved a long task. The Frohmans were unsympathetic. Then, among the managers, there was dissension as well. The Schuberts had been compelled to take the leavings of other Jewish magnates, especially the leavings of Charles Frohman, and the Schuberts revolted. The Schuberts were natives of Syracuse, and their preparation for the theater was not promising of their devotion to art. They were program boys and ushers. Then the haberdashery business claimed them as possibly a speedier course to wealth. Samuel Schubert eventually became a ticket seller in the box office. In due time, having learned a few marketable secrets of the theater, he launched a frivolous burlesque and comedy show. With this, he floated into New York and continued with his musical shows of a shallow kind until the name Schubert has come to be descriptive of the productions. The Schuberts, of course, booked in trust theaters. About the year 1900, the Schuberts quarreled with the Trust and Belasco quarreled with the Frohmans, and the two hailed each other as fellow belligerents and proceeded to see what could be made of their belligerency. The public was showing signs of disgust with the Trust. That was the cue. The Schuberts and the Belasco would appeal to the public to help in the fight against the Trust. Belasco and the Schuberts would play the part of injured independents. Public sympathy would be aroused, and public patronage would boost the independents into the strength of a new trust. This is exactly what occurred. Belasco's theatricalism helped to this end. He is an actor off as well as on the stage. He affects the pose of a benevolent priest and dresses the part wearing a priestly collar with clerical vest and coat. Although of Portuguese Hebraic origin, Belasco dresses after this manner to honor, as he says, a tutor of his early days. Anyway, the costume is very effective, especially with the ladies. He has a tremulous, shy way about him, and he sits in his sanctum with the lights so arranged that his priestly face and his splendid shock of silver hair seem to rise out of an encompassing and shadowy mystery. It is very effective, very effective. One woman declared, after being admitted to the presence and gazing on the face that rose out of the shadows into the light, quote, "I have a better understanding of the divine humility of Jesus Christ since I have been privileged to meet Mr. Belasco," end quote. Thus, the master, as he is called, was well equipped to appeal to public sympathy, and he did appeal. There was no end to his appeal. He told stories of personal attacks made on him. He wrung his hands in desperate grief against the trust's menace to the stage. His own productions, however, were not all immaculate. There was one, Naughty Anthony, which brought the police censor down upon him. But there was a very clear conception in the public mind as to what the trust had done to the stage. Belasco said he was against the trust, and the rest was snap judgment. The Schuberts and Belasco thus found themselves in a very favorable combination of circumstances. Their first financial aid came, strangely enough, through ex-Congressman Rainick, a Jew, and Boss Cox of Ohio, and others who were interested. These supplied the first money. The Schuberts supplied the management. Belasco supplied the wonderful impersonation of a Daniel come to call the Jewish Theater Trust to judgment. The campaign succeeded, and the wealth rolled in. For a time, Belasco did prove to the public that he could produce better plays than the old trust had given to the public, and to that extent he justified public confidence in him. The end of the old trust came in a natural way. The Schuberts became rich and powerful, and the trust was then willing to do business with them. Some of the trust members died, and about 1910, the old trust ceased to exist as the dominant factor in American theatrical affairs. But the rise of the independents did not bring relief. It only captured for Jewish enterprise that part of the theater which might have become the prize of a legitimate body of protesters against the old cheapness and vulgarity. The pretended protest won. The theater was saved to Jewish control. Jewish managers had created the public disgust in the first place. They knew what the public reaction would be, so they prepared to capitalize the reaction and thus control the theater going public, both going and coming. This they did with admirable strategy. During the outbreak, there was some genuine feeling of independence on the part of a few non-Jewish managers. John Court organized a Western theater circuit. Colonel Henry W. Savage swung loose from Claw and Erlanger, as did also William A. Brady. But independence of the Jewish control has never flourished. Wherever it did keep up an independent front, it stood for the theater in its best sense, and served as the only channel of expression for the few remaining stage artists. The coming of the motion picture industry, however, gave true independence its quietus. The motion picture industry, and it is rightly named an industry, is entirely Jewish controlled, and, as it is pushing its way into the legitimate theaters and crowding out human players for long periods every year, theater managers have to bow to it more and more. It remained for the Schuberts, however, to give the theatrical business a most original twist. They made it a real estate speculation. Readers of this article may recall that recently they have read that in their own or a neighboring city, the Schuberts are going to build one or two theaters. In one city, the announcement was made that two theaters were to be built. That particular city happens to need almost everything else but theaters. However, it cannot get anything else it needs, and there is no doubt it will get the theaters. The Schuberts learned this trick when they were supposed to be bucking the trust. They went after any building they could get, and because of the public enmity to the trust, they got better terms than otherwise could have been possible. An old riding school in New York became the Winter Garden. The great Hippodrome, the materialized dream of a non-Jew, Frederick Thompson, was taken over by the Schuberts. It soon dawned on the Schuberts that there was more money in theatrical real estate than in theatrical art. Today, the Schuberts, while nominally theatrical managers, are really dealers in theatrical leases in buildings where theatrical productions are made. A theater, as a real estate proposition, pays amazingly well. Figure up the amount of space you occupy as a show, the length of time you occupy it, and the price you pay for it. It is rent raised to the nth degree. Then the offices which make the bulk of the structure, and the stores in front. Really, the show business is the minor consideration here. What does it cost the Schuberts? Very little but the use of their name. When it is the matter of a new theater, outside capital supplies three-fourths of the money, but the lease and the control are vested in the Schuberts. That is a rather handsome arrangement. In the matter of producing plays, the same arrangement is often followed. The author, star, or their backers supplying the larger part, sometimes all of the capital, while the Schuberts lend their name to the management and take their share of the booking fees and the rental of the theaters where the show is produced. In October of last year, 1920, a serious slump hit the theatrical business. Even in New York, the theaters were experiencing the worst depression of years. More than 3,000 actors were idle, and managers were compelled to resort to cut-rate tickets, ticket agents, that is, to sell their seats. And yet, in the midst of it, Schubert announced 6 new theaters for New York alone. At the same time, they announced the production of 40 plays. 40 plays! If a man announced that he was going to build 6 new art museums in one city and fit them up with the requisite number of oil paintings produced under his own direction, he would be considered crazy, especially if it were a matter of common repute that he knew nothing of art and was having the pictures painted merely to give value to his real estate. It indicates how thoroughly accustomed the public has become to the show business and the motion picture industry that the announcement of these former haberdashers is taken so complacently. 40 plays! When anyone can count on the fingers of both hands and all the present-day American and English playwrights even remotely deserving of notice. It is said that the Schuberts do not expect more than 3 out of 4 plays to succeed. The success of a play, in the artistic sense, is not their business. To maintain enough plays on the road to keep alive their real estate investments is really the thing. Thus, it is not now strange where theatrical slang comes from. An actor who wins success is said to have delivered the goods. An approved actress is all wool and a yard wide. An author puts it over his audience. A girl of no particular class is a skirt. A young chorus girl is a broiler or a chicken. An actress who plays the part of an adventuress is a vamp. A very successful play is a knockout. Taken all together, it is the show business. This is the effect of Jewish control of any profession, as any American lawyer will tell you. The only protest now being offered by these small dramatic clubs, which, whether or not they know it, are the strongest anti-Semitic influence on the theatrical horizon. That's the end of this article. It was published January 22nd, 1921, of course, in the Dearborn Independent. Alright, let's move on to the second half of part 17 here. This next article is entitled "The Jewish Aspect of the Movie Problem." There was once a man named Anthony Comstock, who was the enemy of public lewdness. Of course, he was never popular. No newspaper ever spoke of him without a jeer. He became the stock joke of his time, and it was not very long ago. He died in 1915. It's very noticeable that the men who mocked his life with banal jesting were non-Jews. It's also worth recording that the men who profited from the commercializing of much of the vice which he fought were Jews. It was a very familiar triangle, the morally indignant non-Jew fighting against public lechery, and the Jewish instigators of it hiding behind ribald Gentiles and Gentile newspapers. Well, the fight is still going on. If you will subscribe to a clipping bureau, or if you will look over the press of the country, you will see that the problem of the immoral show has been neither settled nor silenced. In every part of the country, it is intensely alive just now. In almost every state, there are movie censorship bills pending, with the old wet and gambling elements against them, and the awakened part of the decent population in favor of them. Always, the Jewish producing firm's constitution, the silent pressure behind the oppression, behind the opposition. I believe that's supposed to be constitute, not constitution there. Anyways, moving on. This is a grave fact. Standing alone, it would seem to charge a certain Jewish element with intentional gross immorality. But that hardly states the condition. There are two standards in the United States, one ruling very largely in the production of plays, the other reigning, when it does reign, in the general public. One is an Oriental ideal. If you can't go as far as you like, go as far as you can. It gravitates naturally to the flesh and its exposure. Its natural psychic habitat is among the more sensual emotions. This Oriental view is essentially different from the Anglo-Saxon, the American view, and it knows this. Thus is the opposition to censorship accounted for. It is not that the producers of Semitic origin have deliberately set out to be bad according to their own standards, but they know that their whole taste and temper are different from the prevailing standards of the American people, and if censorship were established, there would be danger of American standards being officially recognized, and that is what they would prevent. Many of these producers don't know how filthy their stuff is. It's so natural to them. Scarcely an American home has not voiced its complaint against the movies. Perhaps no single method of entertainment has ever received such widespread and unanimous criticism as the movies, for the reason that everywhere their lure and their lasciviousness has been felt. There are good pictures, of course. It were a pity if that much could not be said. We cling to that statement as if it might prove a ladder to lift us above the cesspool, which the most popular form of public entertainment has become. The case has been stated so often that repetition here is needless. Responsible men and organizations have made their protests without results. The moral appeal needs no response in those to whom it is made because they are able to understand only appeals that touch their material interests. As the matter now stands, the American public is as helpless against the films as it is against any other exaggerated expression of Jewish power. And the American public will continue helpless until it receives such an impression of its helplessness as to shock it into protective action. That's a profound statement. In a powerful indictment of the movie tendency in the National Board of Review of Motion Pictures, Frederick Boyd Stevenson writes in the Brooklyn Eagle, quote, On the other hand, the reels are reeking with filth. They are slimy with sex plays. They are overlapping one another with crime. From bad to worse, these conditions have been growing. The plea is set up that the motion picture industry is the fourth or fifth in the United States, and we must be careful not to disrupt it. A decent photo play, it's argued, brings a gross return of, say, $100,000, while a successful sex play brings from $250,000 to $2.5 million. End quote. Dr. James Effringham was recently quoted in the New York World as saying this, quote, "I attended a meeting of motion picture owners in New York, and I was the only Christian present. The remainder of the company consisted of 500 unchristian Jews," end quote. Now, there is little wisdom in discoursing against evil in the movies and deliberately closing our eyes to the forces behind the evil. The method of reform must change. In earlier years, when the United States presented a more general Aryan complexion of mind and conscience, it was only necessary to expose the evil to cure it. The evils we suffered were lapses. They were fruits of moral inertia or drifting. The sharp word of recall stiffened the moral fiber of the guilty parties and cleared up the untoward condition. That is, evildoers of our own general racial type could be shamed into decency, or at least respectability. That method is no longer possible. The basic conscience is no longer present to touch. The men now mostly concerned with the production of scenic and dramatic filth are not to be reached that way. They do not believe, in the first place, that it is filth. They cannot understand, in the second place, that they are really pandering to and increasing human depravity. When there does reach their mentalities the force of protest, it strikes them as being very funny. They can't understand it. They explain it as due to morbidity, jealousy, or, as we now hear, anti-Semitism. Reader, beware. If you so much as resent the filth of the mass of the movies, you will fall under the judgment of anti-Semitism. The movies are of Jewish production. If you fight filth, the fight carries you straight into the Jewish camp because the majority of the producers are there, and then you are attacking the Jews, as they cry. If the Jews would throw out of their camp the men and methods that so continuously bring shame upon the Jewish name, this fight for decency could be conducted without so much racial reference. An analysis of the motion picture industry in the United States will show the following: that 90% of the production of pictures is in the hands of the 10 large concerns located in NYC in Los Angeles. That each of these has under it a number of complete units, making up the large aggregate of companies seen in photo plays all over the world. That these parent concerns control the market. That 85% of these parent concerns are in the hands of Jews. That they constitute an invincible centralized organization which distributes its produces to tens of thousands of exhibitors, the majority of whom are Jews of an inferior type. That the independent motion pictures have no distributing center but sell in the open market. It may come as a surprise to many people that there is no dearth of good pictures. The trouble is that there is no means by which good pictures can reach the public. One of the notable libraries of beautiful pictures, containing the cream of dramatic and educational films, has been rendered absolutely useless because of the impossibility of getting them before the public. The owners of these pictures achieved a little advance by engaging Jewish salesmen to push the pictures, but against them has always been the huge and silent force of the concentrated opposition, which is apparently against the introduction of decency and delight into the screen world. Once in a while, an independent producer like David Wark Griffith or Charles Ray gives the world a screen production that is not only without offense or propaganda, but it is a veritable delight and joy. These pictures, with their attendant success, are the strongest answers that can be made to the cry of some producers that the only profitable plays are the nasty ones. That cry, of course, is based on fact. Without doubt, as things now go, the nasty pictures are the more profitable, because they are the most elaborately made and the most gorgeously advertised. The very lewdest of them have secured their patronage by advertising that they deal with moral problems. But all public taste is cultivated. Every city which can boast of public spirit has citizens who spend tens of thousands of dollars annually in an attempt to create a community taste for good music. They succeed to a certain extent, but very rarely do they make it pay. It appears that the work of demoralizing the public taste is far more profitable. And as our whole range of public entertainment, outside of the higher musical field, has fallen into the hands of groups who do not know what the term art means, it is evident how overwhelming the appeal of the dollar must be. If the public taste is now so fixedly demoralized that the moving picture producers can confidently claim that the public demands what we're giving it, the case is more damning than otherwise, for it is recognized by all detached observers that such a public taste is a most urgent reason why immediate and heroic remedies should be adopted. Cocaine peddlers can easily establish a public demand for their drugs, and they do, but that demand is never considered to be an extenuation for the peddling of coke. So with the psychic poison and visual filth of the ordinary movie, the demand it has created is morally lawless, and the further satisfaction of the demand is morally lawless as well. Carl Laemmle, one of the leading producers in America and the head of the Universal Film Company, testified before a congressional committee that he had sent a circular entitled, "What Do You Want?" to the exhibitors who bought his pictures. At that time, his company was in communication with about 22,000 exhibitors. Mr. Laemmle says that he expected 95% of the answers to favor clean, wholesome pictures. But instead of finding 95% favoring clean pictures, I discovered that at least one half, this is him being quoted here, or possibly 60%, want pictures to be risque, which is French for smutty. Laemmle himself is a German-born Jew, and did not state what percentage of the replies were from people of what euphemistically is termed his faith. It is a very noticeable fact that whenever any attempt is made to control the tumultuous indecency and triviality which the movies ceaselessly pour out day and night upon the American public, the opposition thereto is Jewish. Take, for example, the attempt to arouse the sober spirit of America to a proper appreciation of what is happening to Sunday, which is the day of rest. The opponents for the whole movement, a movement for the awakening of conscience, not for the passage of laws, are Jews, and they justify their opposition on Jewish grounds. Whenever the movies are before the bar of public opinion, their defenders, as they are Jews. In the congressional hearing before referred to, the lawyers who appeared for the companies were all Jews, distinguished by the names of Myers, Ludwig, Kolm, Friend, and Rosenthal. There was even a Jewish rabbi involved who gave a most ingenious explanation of both Jewish control of the movies and also of Jewish opposition to control of the character of the movies. "I am a Jew," he said. "You know as well as I do that we have been the unfortunate victims of the nasty, biting tongue, and you know as well as I do that the movie first held us up to ridicule and we have not only been disgraced in these movies, but we have had our religion traduced and disgracefully traduced. End quote. If this is true, it is chargeable to the Jews themselves, for Jews have always controlled the business. That it is true is probable, for the most zealous lampooners of the Jews have been Jewish comedians. Non-Jews fail objectively in endeavoring to portray the character. We felt very much hoit, he continued, and we felt there was a remedy, and that remedy was public opinion. And what did we do? We did not come to Congress. We organized a society, the Independent Order of B'nai B'rith, which is the largest Jewish fraternal order in the world. It organized what is called the Anti-Defamation League, with headquarters in Chicago, and the League for the Defense of the Jewish Name, united with other people in the Catholic Church, the True Society, and Holy Name Society, and it wrote to all the movie manufacturers of the country, asking them that they do not traduce the Jewish character and the Jewish religion, and that they do not hold us up to ridicule. That we did not object to the depiction of Jewish character, but we did object to the caricature of Jewish character and the caricature of our name and religion. And after thus having explained to the manufacturers our position, we appointed a committee of men in every city in the country, asking them that they appeal to the municipal authorities that they permit not the presentation of pictures that were calculated to offend the Jewish character and the Jewish sensitiveness. And what has been the result? There has been necessary not a protest, because movies in this country are not producing that class of movies any longer. Of course, there are excellent reasons why the Jewish protests, if any really were necessary, should be instantly obeyed. But why has not the continued and clamorous protest of decent America been equally heeded? Why not? Because the protest has come largely from non-Jews. If the Jews can control the movies to the extent that the rabbi claimed, why cannot they control them for decency? Why do they not control them for decency? The one weakness of the rabbi's statement is the charge that the Jewish religion was traduced. It would be most interesting to learn how this was done and by whom. It is a religion which does not easily lend itself to that sort of treatment, picturesque as some of its forms may appear to alien eyes. There is, however, a meaning hidden in this statement of the rabbi. The Jew considers any public expression of Christian character as being derogatory to his religion. For example, if the president of the U.S., or the governor of your state should make a specifically Christian allusion in his Thanksgiving proclamation, or mention the name of Christ, that act would be protested as offensive to Jewish sensitiveness. Not only would that be done, but it has been done. In the same hearing referred to, quotation was made from a letter written by Carl H. Pierce, special representative of the Oliver Marasco Photoplay Company, to the executive secretary of the Motion Picture Board of Trade, in which the following statement appeared, quote, "You and I have seen boards turn down such plays as The Life of the Savior because they thought it might offend the Hebrews." End quote. It's apparent that Jewish sensitiveness, quote-unquote, is a spoiled child which has been unduly coddled, and that it has interfered to such an extent that the real question becomes one of non-Jewish rights. The Jewish defenders have been asking, why should a nation of 110 million people be considered in danger from 3 million Jews? And Gentile fronts, with all the zest of a new idea, have shouted the same challenging question. It might be advantageous to answer thus, why should a country of 110 million people, mostly of Christian faith and practice, be prevented from seeing the life of the Savior portrayed on the screen because it is feared to offend the Jews? The answer in both cases is not a comparison of numbers, but a recognition of the fact that, as in the motion picture world, the Jews are at the neck of the bottle where they can absolutely control what goes to the public. So they are in other fields at corresponding places of control. But whether the Jewish producer is qualified to do better than he is doing is a question. When you consider the conditions from which many of them sprang, you will be rendered rather hopeless of voluntary reform. Why were not Way Down East and The Shepherd of the Hills put on the screen by Jews? Because the Jews in control of the movies have no knowledge of American rural life, and therefore no feeling for it. The Jew is a product of city life, and that peculiar phase of city life which is found in the ghetto. He sees in a farmer only a hick and a rube. You may rest entirely assured that it was not the Yankee, himself a product of the farms, who turned the agriculturalist into a joke, until today the joke has emptied our farms of men. The theatrical hick and a rube of the gold brick story and the hayseed play were of Jewish origin. The Jew is a product of city life, and of that phase of city life where the wits play a large part. The America of the average Jew, who caters to the entertainment of Americans, is comprehended in a beaten path from the box office to backstage, and thence to an eating place. He doesn't know America as yet, except as a huge aphis which he may milk. It follows, therefore, that in all probability he is equally ignorant of American home life. He has not yet been able to understand what American domesticity means. The American home is an almost unknown quantity to foreigners of the Eastern races. An Armenian woman who has lived in America for 5 years says that she knows nothing of an American home save what she can see through the windows as she passes. This, of course, is a lack not easily to be bridged over. It may not be strictly true that the majority of movie producers do not know the interior of American homes, but there is certainly every indication that they have not caught its spirit, and that their misrepresentation of it is more than a false picture. It's also a most dangerous influence. It's dangerous to foreigners who gain their most impressive ideas of Americans' life from the stage. It's dangerous to Americans who fancy that the life of the screen is the life that is lived by the better classes. If we can map the community mind of whole sections of our cities and trace the impressions of American people, American habits, and American standards which those mind groups hold, we should then see the dangerous misrepresentation which movie producers have given to things American. Falsity, artificiality, criminality, and jazz are the keynotes of the mass of screen productions. American life is bare and meager to the Eastern mind. It is not sensuous enough. It is devoid of intrigue. Its women of the homes do not play continuously and hysterically on the sex motif. It is a life made good and durable by interior qualities of faith and quietness. And these, of course, are death to the orientally minded. There lies the whole secret of the movie's moral failure. They are not American, and their producers are racially unqualified to reproduce the American atmosphere. An influence which is racially, morally, and idealistically foreign to America has been given the powerful projecting force of the motion picture business, and the consequences are what we see. The purpose of this and succeeding articles is not to lift hands in horror and point out how rotten the movies are. Everybody is doing that. The case against the movies is not contested at all. It's unanimous. Women's clubs, teachers, newspaper editors, police officers, judges of the court, ministers of religion, physicians, mothers and fathers, everybody knows just what the movies are. What all these disgusted groups evidently do not know is this. Their protests will be entirely useless until they realize that behind the movies there is another group of definite moral character, of definite moral and racial complexion, to whom the protest of non-Jews amounts to next to nothing at all, if they can possibly circumvent it. As the rabbi previously quoted showed, the Jews got what they wanted from the producers as soon as they made the request. What have the non-Jewish teachers, women's clubs, newspaper editors, police officers, judges, ministers of religion, physicians, and just plain parents of the rising generation, what have they obtained for all their complaints and protests? Nothing. And they can go on beating the air for a lifetime and still obtain no improvement unless they face the unpleasant racial fact that the movies are Jewish. It is not a question of morals. That question has been settled. It is a question of management. When the people know who and what is this intangible influence we call the movies, the problem may not appear to be so baffling. Published on February 12, 1921, of course, in the Dearborn Independent. Well, this probably doesn't surprise any of us who are listening, right? But we have to appreciate that almost 100 years ago, Henry and his writers of this series, his researchers of this series, they correctly sniffed this out and pointed out the fact that the entertainment business, the movies, the talkies, as they called them back then, when they had sound, and the theater plays, which we touched on in part one, these were all, for the large part, you could say, as a whole, Jewish. And people still today, 100 years removed, still can't get this through their head. And they sit there and wonder, and all these Christian churches and all these Zio-Christian parents in America, they just can't figure out why the movies are so filthy and why their kids are degenerates. And it's because they've been victims of Jewish entertainment. And Jewish entertainment is a business. It is a business for profit. And they know sex sells, they know animal instincts sell, killing, murder, crime, all that kind of fantastical stuff that you don't encounter in your everyday life. That's all very intriguing stuff, and Gentiles simply don't have the discipline or the character to rise above it and see what it is, sadly enough. Sad to say, that is the truth. So anyways, let's give Henry and his researchers here credit that they were able to see this even back then and point this out. And my goodness, I think Henry might die of a heart attack if he saw some of the things that were in movies today. Some of the things that are on the internet. I want to say, too, that this is part 17. We are not even 200 pages into this 500-page document. And let me just say that some of these are not that interesting to us today because they talk about things that were happening in 1920 and 1919 and 1921 that are... for instance, this motion picture stuff and talking about the famous actors of that time. I don't know who any of these people are. Hardly any of them. So let me just say that some of this is kind of dragging. Some of these articles aren't all that interesting. Some of them are a bit fluffy in my opinion. But I said I was going to read the entire thing. And that's what we're going to do. So, I apologize if some of it seems boring. I said I would do the entire thing. That's what we're here doing. I won't skip any parts that I have in this particular document, which I believe to be the full four-volume set compiled into a PDF. And if you don't like some parts, Trust me, I totally get it. Some of these are not that interesting to read, and they're a bit laborious to sit here and read out loud and try to make it sound coherent and not be choppy while I read it. So there's a few parts that I have to go back and edit out or restate. And if I did that with every little word, it would take me forever. So I'm leaving in most of the little ones. But anyways, I don't want to go on too long. Thanks for tuning in, guys. This has been part 17 of The International Jew by Henry Ford. And until next time, take care. Praise Christ. Praise God. God bless you all. Bye-bye.